Right now, with this conflict in Israel, it seems that the case of peace for Ukraine is getting more and more serious. When it comes to the peace talks, to the negotiations, how do you see this? How we can carry out these type of negotiations? What are the most important elements to be considered for such negotiations?
Well, before you can have any peace negotiations, you have to have two sides that are willing to enter into those negotiations. At the moment, there's only one side that is serious about a ceasefire and a peace settlement, and that's the Russian side. You know, the Ukrainian side, the Western side, hasn't yet got to the point where it's willing to engage in a serious negotiation with Russia about a peace settlement. There's a lot of talk in the Western media at the moment about the possibility of some kind of a ceasefire. The idea being that you stop the war and you provide some kind of a breathing space for Ukraine to repair its defenses, to rebuild its armed forces, and for its Western supporters to ramp up their aid to Ukraine. Okay. But that's just pure fantasy, because Russia is never going to agree to any ceasefire that is not linked to, at least to the outlines of, a more general peace settlement. It's not going to agree to any ceasefire that doesn't lead very directly to enhancing Russian security, to securing the security goals of the special military operation. And it's certainly not going to agree to any ceasefire just going to give Ukraine a chance to recover from its recent defeats and resume military action at some point in the future. So in my view, Russia is willing to negotiate a peace, and the details of any peace settlement will obviously emerge in the process of negotiations, and we very much linked to what the situation is at the time, how the war has progressed, what the situation on the battlefield is, what the general conditions are, but the general outline of a feasible peace settlement is fairly clear now. And a feasible peace looked at from the Russian perspective would be that Ukraine would either accept or at least acquiesce in Russia's acquisition of territory, former Ukraine territory, the four oblasts plus Crimea. There will be a security deal which will mean that there will no longer be a NATO Ukrainian threat on Russia's borders. There will be provisions which will protect the interests of pro-Russian elements in Ukraine, and possibly there'll be some kind of perspective of about a wider European security settlement and a wider security arrangements developed between Russia and the rest, and particularly between Russia and the United States. So that's the kind of peace deal you're looking at. I call it a compromise peace. Other people refer to it as a peace for land or peace for territory kind of deal. That's what's there. The negotiations about that kind of a peace settlement could be started tomorrow. It wouldn't be easy. It would take a while. It'd be very complicated. But move towards such a settlement could begin straight away, and there could be a perspective of bringing this war to an end within a few months. Anyway, okay, but the problem is that on the Ukrainian and Russian side, there's no inclination at the moment to engage in serious peace negotiations. There are some on the Western side who are arguing that maybe Ukraine should embrace a perspective of negotiating an end to the war, but so far there's been no political uptake of that kind of approach as far as it now stands. Ukraine stated position is to fight on and, you know, and to win the war, to regain all the territories it lost to Russia, not just since February 22, but since, you know, since 1991, to inflict a defeat on Russia, to regime change. That's the that's the Ukrainian position, and the Ukrainian position is broadly endorsed, supported by Western politicians. You know, the whole position of, you know, we'll support Ukraine for as long as it takes. So until that position changes, until Ukraine and the West are willing to engage in serious negotiations with Russia, which will involve various concessions by Ukraine and by the West, serious questions, there will be no peace negotiations. Now, I suppose the question then is, what are the prospects? Are we going to remain stuck in this position forever? And it's possible that we may be. That it's possible that, you know, there will be no peace negotiations or actual peace settlement. The war will continue to some kind of a conclusion. At some point, you know, the war, the fighting, will come to an end. But there'll be no agreed peace settlement. Okay, and you know, there are plenty on the Western side, Western hardliners who want that to happen, because as far as they're concerned, the most important thing is not what happens to Ukraine, it's what happens to Western rivalry, competition, confrontation with Russia. So that's what Western hardliners want. They call it containment. It's their latest buzzword. We need to contain Russia. But basically, it's continuing to fight a proxy war with Russia through Ukraine forever, if that is at all possible. Okay, the problem with that perspective is, of course, that it's not the Western hardliners, the Western states that are doing the actual fighting on the ground. It's Ukraine, it's Ukrainian people. It's Ukrainian people are dying in the hundreds of thousands. It's the Ukrainian state, economy, society, culture even, that is being destroyed by this war. And the longer the war goes on, the worse the outcome it's going to be for Ukraine, and it could be an outcome that actually threatens the very existence of Ukraine as an independent sovereign state. Whereas, you know, as of now, you know, Ukraine, okay, it would be a costly peace deal from Ukraine's point of view, a very unpalatable peace deal, but at least it could be a deal that would, Ukraine would survive as an independent sovereign state. It would have lost maybe 20% of its territory, but would retain control of the other 80%. There will be some kind of, you know, prospects for Ukraine going forward. So, you know, what the Ukrainians should do is actually begin to embrace the alternatives of negotiations and peace with Russia. And given Ukraine's dire straits, given the failure of this, you know, so-called counter-offensive, you know, given that Russia now has the military initiative, given that the only perspective for Ukraine in military terms is continuing to fight a losing war of attrition with Russia, okay, that could go on for some time, but it's still a losing war, and it's still a war that ultimately ends in defeat. If that's the perspective, that's the reality, and that reality is recognized, then maybe on the Ukrainian side and the Western side, or at least some elements on the Western side, will begin to sort of shift their position. But there's no sign of that at the moment.
So we had Lloyd Austin recently went to Kiev. What was the reason behind this trip?
Well, we don't precisely know. The speculation is that he went there, and you know, it's one of a number of meetings, trips to see Zelensky by American officials, to persuade or suggest to Zelensky that the Ukrainians should actually start to move in the direction of a ceasefire and some kind of a peace settlement, because you know the United States doesn't want to take the initiative itself because it's stated position that if there's going to be a ceasefire and peace negotiations, it has to be Ukraine. And of course, you know, if the United States will come out in favor of actually heading in the direction of a ceasefire and peace, that would be a tremendous kind of loss of face on the part of the American. Biden's administration. It would represent a severe political, psychological, and moral defeat for the Biden administration. So they don't want to do it. They want Zelensky and the Kiev regime. They want them to actually take the responsibility for initiating, beginning to send out signals about peace, which then they will get behind. But of course, Zelensky's government doesn't want to do that because the problem is that for it to do that would mean an equally, if not greater, loss of political face by Zelensky and his regime, because it would give the lie to all the constant provocations that Ukraine claims that Ukraine's going to win the war, that everything's fine, the constant state of denial about how badly the war is going for Ukraine. From their perspective, once they start talking about peace, then their days in power, in government, in Ukraine are numbered. And of course, they have a particular problem as well, where there are quite important, influential, radical nationalists. And indeed fascist and neo-Nazi elements in Ukraine who won't actually accept any kind of a peace deal, even if it means the destruction of the whole Ukrainian state. So they represent the threat. So Zelensky's mission is very difficult. So the obstacles on the Western side, I said earlier that on the Russian side, there is a willingness to do a deal. I think that's true of Putin personally. Also, I think that Putin has the power and popularity to actually deliver on a deal, even a deal that wouldn't be to the complete liking of elements on the Russian side, because Russia has its own radicals and extremists and ultras as well who don't want to negotiate and don't want any peace. They just want to go for total victory. But I think Putin has he has the popularity and power to actually deliver a peace deal. Okay, but the obstruction to peace negotiations on the Western side is fundamentally political. It's political. It's all about domestic political calculations in Washington and in Kiev. And of course, looming in the future is Trump and the presidential election. And obviously, the Biden administration is trying to calculate that as well. Obviously, I don't think they would want to fight an election campaign against Trump, fighting this losing war of attrition, this losing proxy war with Russia and Ukraine. I think that could potentially be disastrous for them. So their preference would be that there seems to be a solution to the war. Ongoing, happening, some kind of like end to the war. It's not going to be another forever war. It's going to come to an end. And the way they want that to happen, to ensure that they suffer the least political damage or minimize their political damage, is for the Zelensky regime to actually to take the initiative in that regard. But as we just discussed, Zelensky is very reluctant to do it because it means effectively the end of his regime and perhaps his personal security may come under threat from ultras in Ukraine. So what's the way out of that position? Well, one way it might be that it gets so bad. It depends what happens in the war on the front line. How the military situation develops in Ukraine. If it gets so bad for Ukraine that it becomes absolutely clear that they're going to lose big time in the next few months and perhaps even the danger of a complete military collapse by Ukraine. If that perspective really becomes very crystal clear, then that might concentrate minds in both Washington and Kiev to actually take the plunge, maybe together, to actually the political look, the political losses from going for peace will be less than, you know, the complete disaster that awaits them if they continue to fight the war. So that one might be one way out of it, you know, that Washington and Kiev's hand might be forced by military events on the ground in Ukraine. But on the other hand, that might happen. You know, there may be no, you know, I think the Russians are winning the war. They're making progress. They have the initiative. That will continue. I don't see that being reversed in the future, at least not in strategic terms. So, you know, so the fighting could go on for quite some considerable time. So that's one thing. Another possibility was actually suggested by Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute. You know, he published an article, might have been today or yesterday, in which he saw one way out of this kind of political logjam to open up the path to negotiations might be if there's some kind of initiative by the global south, by China, by India, by the BRICS, from coming from that quarter, is that there might be some initiative coming. There could be some initiative coming from there saying, look, let's have a ceasefire, let's have sensible peace negotiations, and an outcome that satisfies, you know, the various conflicting, not satisfies, but deals with the various conflicting interests. That might provide political cover for the United States and for Kiev, and also for, you know, the other players involved there, you know, the European governments, the EU as well, to actually, you know, we've sort of stepped back from their policy of continuing the war at all costs. And I think that's an interesting possibility. And if something like that happens, one thing I am certain of, that initiative will be welcomed and embraced by Moscow, by Putin, and the Russian side. You know, that's the most important message you get across here. You know, the Western hardliners say, you know, there's no point in negotiating peace because you can't have peace with Putin. He's a mad dictator bent on expansionism, domination. You can't trust him. You can't have peace with him. So the only thing you can do with Putin is to fight him. That's their rationalization for continuing, actually, with a disastrous war. No matter how disastrous it gets, they're always going to say, it's going to get worse. It'll be worse if we end the war, or if we start making concessions to Putin, or we start to, you know, engage with him in diplomacy. None of that is true. Putin isn't a mad dictator. He doesn't have particularly expansive aims in relation to his war. His aims, so far anyway, are quite limited. It's about Russian security, the security of Russia's compatriots in Ukraine. Achieving what Russia went to war for in February 22, which was to actually to deal with this NATO-Ukrainian military threat as it saw it, that was materializing and it's worse. And Putin's calculation was that it was better to go to war then rather than to put off that kind of decision, because, you know, the stronger NATO's position in Ukraine got, the stronger the Ukrainians got, and the stronger the nationalist elements in Ukraine got, the more extreme elements, the worse it would be for Russia in the future. Now, personally, I think he was wrong. I think that I don't agree with Putin's decision to invade, but that was his rationale. But the main point is that Putin's goals in relation to Ukraine are limited. He doesn't want to destroy, occupy, control, dominate the whole of Ukraine. He wants to keep control of these four oblasts that have been formally incorporated into the Russian Federation as territories of the Russian Federation. He wants guarantees in relation to Russian security. He wants to look after the interests of pro-Russian elements in Ukraine. He wants to develop a much more equitable set of relations more generally in international relations between the West and Russia and the West of the world. So that's the most important argument we need to have, is that it is possible to negotiate to make peace with Putin, to arrive at a deal that will satisfy his demands, his Russia's interests, but also at the same time, you know, save Ukraine, save Ukrainian sovereignty, save Ukrainian people from yet more tragedy and catastrophe. If this war continues to go on.
You talk about that in the West, hardliners are talking about that we cannot trust Putin. Putin has been in power in Russia for pretty good time, and we can evaluate how was his performance in his position. Do we have any single case that he broke his agreement with the West?
Well, of course, the Western hardliners will point to various things that Putin did, which they say buttresses their case that he can't be trusted, and that he has this expansionist kind of bent that he wants to, recreate a Russian or Soviet empire. Okay, so they would actually point to say the Russian Georgian war, border war of 2008, and they would point to that. But of course, that particular conflict was started by the Georgians, so the Russian intervention in the war, when Dmitry Medvedev was the Russian president, not Putin, was in response to that. Of course, Western hardliners were also, point to what happened in Ukraine in 2014, and Russia's occupation of Crimea. Okay, but it's more complicated than that, because that was preceded by a violent uprising in Kiev and a parliamentary coup, which brought down a democratically elected president, and also Crimea, was a case of secession more than of annexation by Russia, because the Crimeans, didn't want to remain part of Ukraine. They wanted to be part of Russia, and that was their clearly expressed wishes. And again, they would point to Russian support for the rebellion in Donetsk and Lugansk, the Donbass insurgency, the Donbass opposition against the Kiev regime. But actually, Putin and the Russian government were actually very reluctant to get involved in that dispute. Yes, they did actually get involved in it in order to save the Donbass rebels from being defeated by the Kiev government. But subsequently, what they did, is that they signed the Minsk agreements with the West. And the idea in Minsk agreements was that Donetsk and Lugansk would be reincorporated into Ukraine on the basis of being given a fair degree of regional autonomy. But the Kiev government, the Ukrainian nationalists, signed up to that deal, but they didn't really like it, and they never had any real intention of implementing it. So for years, the Russians, tried the best that they could to actually secure the implementation of the Minsk agreements, which, had they been implemented, would have meant that Donetsk and Lugansk would remain part of Ukraine. Okay, Crimea would remain outside of Ukraine, but that's a separate case. And this whole conflict situation, this whole war, could have been avoided. But as a result of the failure of the Minsk agreements, as a result of NATO's expansion into Ukraine and the building up Ukraine militarily by NATO, which from Putin's point of view, from a Russian point of view, was seen as being increasingly threatening. As a result of that, we've got this decision by Putin to go to war. And not only is there no chance that Donetsk and Lugansk are ever going to become part of Ukraine again, the same also applies to Kherson and Zaporizhia. Those territories, or regions, or at least the parts of those regions which are occupied by Russian troops, they're never going to return to Ukraine. And if the war continues, It's possible that for strategic reasons, if nothing else, Russia's territorial ambitions in relation to Ukraine might grow, might expand. The four oblasts might not be enough from their perspective. They might have to expand all the way to the Dnieper River, take control of the whole of eastern and southern Ukraine. And I think that if the war doesn't come to an end in the next few months, or if there isn't some kind of ceasefire and peace negotiation, that seems to me that's very likely is what is going to happen. The Western hardliners have their version of history, their version of these past events, which they think supports their kind of like concept of, that you can't trust Putin, you can't do a deal with Putin. But that wouldn't be my I'm a historian, that wouldn't be my perspective. In relation to the Minsk agreements, as far as I can see, the only party to those agreements that was really sincerely determined to see their implementation was Putin and the Russian government. Putin said this so many, many times. I'm absolutely confident that that Putin, okay, he wants to win the war and secure the Russian position, as I've said already. But I also think he wants peace as well, and he's prepared to do a peace deal. And I think that at least, Putin would actually stick to any agreement that he made with Ukraine and with us, notwithstanding the fact that there will be radical Russian nationalists or militants who actually won't like that. What will say, no, you can't trust the West. We shouldn't stop our war. We should keep going until we've occupied the whole of Ukraine, or it's under our control. Ukraine is completely defeated. The West is completely defeated. That's the only basis for Russian security, is a total victory in this war. Now, I don't think that's right, and I don't think Putin. I don't very much doubt that Putin thinks that right. I expect that Putin, realizes that the costs of total war will be huge, and there's no guarantee that it'll get you the security you want anyway. Ending the war, making an agreement, a peace settlement, that will be risky because there can be no guarantees, there can be no certainty, and there is a lack of trust on all sides. But if the conflict is going to come to an end, on any reasonable basis, then both sides are going to have to take some risks for the sake of a peace settlement. Now, I'm fairly confident that Putin and the Russian side would be prepared to take those kind of risks, which is not to say that they're going to give up any of their essential interests. They're not going to try and gain as much of the war as they can. But I think they will be prepared to make concessions, to make compromises, risky concessions, risky compromises. The problem lies on the Western side. It's the complete absence, at least among the current batch of Western politicians, to be prepared to take any risks for peace. Instead, they seem intent of continuing the war and taking all the risks of the war. But of course, the risks are not really their risks. They're the risks for Ukraine, the Ukrainian people. They're the ones who are bearing the burden of Western risk-taking behavior, not the Western politicians themselves, not the Western countries themselves, at least not directly.
You talk about the importance of United States supporting Ukraine. We know that in 2024, we have a new election in the U.S. Do you think that Ukraine gonna receive, if a Republican wins, the Ukrainian would receive the support that they have been receiving during these 18, 19 months? Is it going to change all the calculations?
Well, at the moment, of course, Congress is blocking. Republicans in Congress are blocking a new kind of a new budget for support to Ukraine. So the Biden administration is running out of funds to be able to use in relation to Ukraine, and they're also having great difficulty. They're also running out of weapons, ammunition. They're having great difficulty in. Well, they're unable to provide what Ukraine needs to actually continue to fight this war. Whereas on the other side, Russian side, there are no such problems. Russia's war production is getting stronger all the time, and its material advantage over Ukraine and over NATO is growing all the time. So at the moment, there's a big problem with aid for Ukraine. But I don't see any situation where the aid is going to dry up completely. Yeah, but it seems very likely that it's going to be less than it was. Actually, less than it was at a time when Ukraine needs it more than ever, in order to be able to hang on in there against growing Russian military power and growing Russian military successes. So material aid position, the Ukrainian situation is going to get very precarious in the next few months. And then, of course, we have the American election, and what's going to happen as a result of that? If Trump wins, what's Trump going to do? Okay, the signs are that the U.S. support for Ukraine could get even less under Trump than it is going to get anyway under Biden. And then we have the Middle East situation, and the call on U.S. resources, particularly military resources, that represents. And in the end, the United States politicians across the political spectrum, including Trump as well, Israel is much more important ally to the United States than Ukraine is. Yeah, so that's another pressure bearing down on Ukraine and its prospect. And of course, in the West, that's why all these Western hardliners are now constantly writing articles saying, okay, yeah, we need to face up to the realities of this war. But that Ukraine, isn't winning it, and there's no immediate prospects it's going to win it. They're very reluctant to go a step further and say, well, of course, Russia is winning it, and if there's going to be any victory of this war, it's going to be Russia. They won't go that far, but they said, well, we need to recognize the reality of where we are militarily in Ukraine. But at the same time, we need to, Ukraine needs to keep fighting. We need what they call a policy or strategy of containment, the containment of Russia. And the best way to contain Russia is for Ukraine to keep this war going, for the Western proxy war of Russia to keep going through Russia. So dig in for the long haul. But what they don't say is, well, are the resources for such a containment strategy to keep Ukraine going, are they going to be available? It increasingly seems that they're not, although I don't think the aid will completely run out, but I don't see the kind of strategy, this containment strategy that Western hardliners are arguing for. I really don't see that the necessary resources are going to be forthcoming for that strategy. And then the other problem, of course, is that it assumes that the Ukrainians are going to continue to keep fighting this war, and is that the case given the losses they've suffered? And the Ukrainian problem is not just a problem of materiel; it's a problem of manpower or of their human resources. And this is another thing the Western hardliners just never ever talk about, never really confront, is the extent of Ukrainian casualties. What they do is they sidestep Ukrainian losses. They say, oh yeah, obviously they've suffered heavy losses, particularly the counteroffensive, they suffered their losses. But they don't really get into the details of that. Instead, what they do, then they suddenly make a jump and they say, well, of course the Russians have suffered these huge losses. According to Ukraine, Russia has lost 300,000 dead in this war. That's a very common figure that they cite, which is what Ukrainian propaganda claims. But the actual reality is this, is that Russia, in terms of fatalities, as far as I can see, and there's some very good data on this, very good data, solid data, has maybe lost up to 50,000 dead. And it's the Ukrainians who've suffered 300,000 fatalities, as well as hundreds of thousands of more wounded and other kinds of losses as well. How long can Ukraine keep fighting this Western proxy war? You know, how long can this Western containment strategy being proposed by the OLAF, how long could it sustain itself on the battlefield in Ukraine? I'm just very, very doubtful about it. But you know, I could be wrong. I mean, maybe the Ukrainians will be able to sustain this war for a lot longer than we might think. And it, notwithstanding the huge casualties there's some. But what kind of future Ukraine is that going to result in? As far as I can see, the longer the Ukrainians hang on in their military, the longer they continue to fight their war, the worse their future as a state, as a nation, as a people is going to be. And again, it's worth just stating the obvious. The parties to this conflict that needs peace most of all is not the West, it's not Russia, it's Ukraine. It's Ukraine that has paid the biggest price of this war. It's Ukraine's whole future that's at stake. Ukraine needs peace, even though the peace, will entail territorial losses. It will entail security commitments in relation to Russia, which they may not want to give. It will entail domestic policies which Ukrainian nationalists won't like. Policies that will protect the pro-Russian elements. All kinds of terrible things from a Ukrainian perspective, but nevertheless, the country, the society, the culture, the state will survive with the prospect of a long-term revival, including possibly, but I'm skeptical here, membership of the EU, and including actually, I think it's even possible that as part of some kind of overall like peace settlement, I think it's possible that Putin and the Russians might actually concede Ukrainian membership of NATO, not necessarily immediately, but as a matter of principle, providing, of course, that Ukrainian of membership of NATO is not going to lead to the revival of this Ukrainian NATO military threat to Russia. So there'll be all kinds of it'd be hedged around, but I'm sure most people think I'm being crazy, but I think it's possible that the Russians could concede Ukrainian membership of NATO under certain conditions. And actually, in terms of some kind of like detailed peace negotiation, that kind of concession by the Russians might provide some welcome political cover for Western politicians and for Ukrainian politicians to be able to swallow the pill of all the other concessions that they're going to have to make in order to sustain a ceasefire and get a settlement. But as I said earlier, at the moment there's no sign whatsoever that's the direction we're heading in.
Do you think that Ukraine joining NATO it's the whole reason of this war? How can that be possible?
I said to people, probably think I'm crazy, but my reasoning is this: is that okay? If there's going to be a settlement, right, an agreed settlement, right, and there may not be. So if there's no settlement, then what I'm saying is kind of irrelevant. But if there's going to be an agreed settlement, it will likely include some kind of security guarantee for Ukraine going forward. Yes, right. So what kind of security guarantee would be? In my view, actually, Ukraine as a member or associate member or something like that, would actually be, from a Russian point of view, the safest possible security guarantee, because then it would be subject to the collective decision making of NATO. Yeah, it wouldn't be left to the whims of particular Western governments who might sign up for a security guarantee. So, being a member of Ukraine, being a member of NATO, could be actually quite an effective way of containing it as a security threat to Russia. And the analogy we can draw is actually with the history of NATO itself. Famously, well, I think it was the first Secretary General of NATO. I think it was a British military guy. I can't remember his name offhand. But he said, you know, the purpose of NATO is to keep the Russians out of Europe, to keep the Americans in Europe, to keep them committed to Europe militarily after the Second World War, but also to keep the Germans down. That's to say, NATO conceived as a container for the post-war resurgence of German power. So NATO could actually function as a kind of safeguard from the Russian Russian point of view, and also it could be a very attractive political solution from the US and Ukrainian point of view. Okay, now I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm not predicting or prophecy, or I'm not even sort of claiming, you know, this is what's on Putin's mind or this is part of the Russian agenda. I'm just saying it's a possibility, and actually, you know, it's going to take a lot of creativity and flexibility in order to actually negotiate any kind of sustainable peace settlement. So I'm making the point as a way of, making an argument for, keeping an open mind as to what the possibilities about how this war can be brought to an end, and how any peace can be sustained, and how the various interests and needs of the parties to the peace summit, how they can be fulfilled.
Can the West provide some sort of security as they have provided for Israel without joining NATO? That could be the case for Ukraine.
Yeah, it could be, but my argument is that actually it would be from a Russian point of view, it would be better if Ukraine was part of NATO, an associate or some kind of formal relationship with NATO, and NATO itself provided the guarantee, because then the implementation of that guarantee would be a collective function of NATO. And of course, NATO involves, many different countries, yes, including some that have a rather sensible perspective on this war in Ukraine and the relations with Russia. Countries like Hungary, countries like Slovakia, Turkey, countries that in the future, could have much governments with a much much more friendly disposition towards Russia than the current crop of politicians. So actually, having that collectivity responsible for Ukraine's security going forward, but it's also responsible for actually containing the Ukrainians, making sure they stick to their side of the bargain. Yes, right. They don't become reemerge as a threat to Russia that in the future that could precipitate another conflict. I don't suppose this position I'm arguing is ever going to materialize itself, but I'm very happy to actually defend it as a matter of principle, as actually being the best solution to this problem of what kind of guarantee of Ukraine's security for the future is going to satisfy the West, it's going to satisfy the Ukrainians, and it's also going to serve Russian interests as well. But maybe you're right. Russia's invested a huge amount, Putin has invested a huge amount of political capital in fundamentally saying no to Ukraine's membership of NATO. So maybe what I'm saying is not possible, but maybe not. Maybe associate membership, or maybe it should become by some kind of NATO-Ukraine partnership, which is actually, and the other thing, of course, is the reality is, Ukraine is de facto a member of NATO. Yeah, it's integrated into NATO in all kinds of ways. Yeah, the only thing it doesn't have is a kind of security guarantee for NATO that would draw NATO member states into war with Russia. The current war, of course, right? But once the war's over, once there's a peace settlement, then it looks very different, doesn't it? I put it this way: Putin didn't go to war just because he didn't like the idea of Ukraine becoming a member of NATO, or for the symbolism involved in that, or because in general he didn't like NATO expansion. He found it friend. He went to war because he saw a specific concrete material threat emerging on Russia's borders in the form of NATO's actual military buildup of Ukraine, right? And Ukraine's actual practical integration into NATO's political and defensive military structure, right? Once there's a war, once that threat is gone, then the question of NATO membership of Ukraine, it's actually in many ways a kind of secondary issue, matter of politics actually, rather than anything else. But we'll see.
How do you see Europe today? Are they all united? As we saw when this war started, they were so united, mostly united. Do they have any backup plan in case a Republican wins the election in 2024?
Well, there was this Politico article, which you drew to my attention, where the proposal is that in order to keep Trump on board with the Ukraine war, to continue the war. It's all part of the argument about containment, continuing the war, as long as it takes, forever war, fight to last Ukraine. It's all part of the same kind of discourse out there. This one person said, well, what Europe should do, it should agree to buy, the figure it used was $45 billion in arms from the United States every year, every single year, and then give it to the Ukrainians. And if they did that, that would keep Trump happy because he's a businessman, and he'd be very happy if the Europeans are putting their hands in their pockets and funding the Ukraine war, as long as the United States doesn't do it. Well, that particular article, it talks about Europe, but it didn't say when it means Europe, what does that mean? is it the EU, or is it Europe more broadly? $45 billion a year. Okay. It's not small change, is it, right? Who's going to pay for it? Where is the funding going to come for it? There's certainly countries one could already identify in Europe that won't be happy with such an arrangement, Hungary and Slovakia at the present time. And there's certainly other countries that won't want to, won't want to pick up the major part of the tab while other countries are freeloaded. So I think it's completely unrealistic proposal. But on the other hand, it sums up the kind of like the desperation of the European situation, is that they've completely aligned themselves with the United States in relation to Ukraine and the proxy war with Russia. And after all, it's a war that's been fought on Europe's doorstep, not in the United States, and in doing so, they've kind of like increased even further their military and security dependence on the United States, because they don't have the means to actually fight this proxy war on their own. And yet, on the other hand, there's a very real prospect that Biden's going to lose the presidential election, and we're going to have a Trump administration, which could well abandon the Ukrainians completely. I'm not saying it will, but it's certainly a possibility that if Trump becomes president again, one thing for sure he's going to say, if the war in Ukraine is ongoing, he's going to say, well, he's certainly going to say, well, it's up to Europeans to step up to the plate and support Ukraine and fight this proxy war with Russia. The United States will step, maybe not step down from the plate, will certainly take a step back. So how are they going to respond to that? Do they have any plan to deal with that situation? I don't think they do. I think they're just hanging on in there, hoping that Ukrainians will be able to continue the fight, that something's going to turn up, that it's very hard to to put yourself, I mean, some of them are obviously, I would presume, believe their own propaganda and their own rhetoric about, the Russian threat and Putin threat and the existential threat. They believe that. So if you believe that, then really, you've got no choice except to just to continue with what you've been doing before, this proxy war with Russia through Ukraine. I hope that not all of these Western politicians are so mighty. I hope there's, you know, some more, you know, least pragmatic elements among them. But of course, their problem is that you know, they have the same problem as the Americans and Zelensky has in terms of extricating themselves politically without losing huge amount of political face, without, you know, imperiling their power positions in different countries. So they find it enormously you know, difficult, you know, to retreat from, you know, from the positions they put themselves in, which is, you know, going all in on this proxy war with Russia. But again, going back to you know, the suggestion by Anatole Levin, this kind of idea of a global South initiative, maybe that might you know, enable the Europeans to get themselves off the hook in relation to war. Or maybe, as I said earlier, if this situation gets so dire, even they might have to, you know, change their policy and embrace diplomacy, negotiations, peace settlement, irrespective of the political cost it's going to be to them. Because if they don't do that, you know, the outcomes are going to be so disastrous that the political cost they'll have to bear will be even greater.
Has this conflict in Israel shifted the U.S. focus from Ukraine to Gaza to Palestine? How do you see this?
Gaza, what's going on there, has partially, I'd say partially, restored my confidence in Western mainstream media. Only partially, and it's only, I'm only talking about the media that I engage with, I read, because actually the handling of, you know, the conflict there, the war there, has been relatively even-handed. Yeah, there's, you know, there's been much more even-handed treatment of the two sides and the arguments and the perspectives, and, you know, a much more critical handling of the propaganda battle that's going on. So when you compare it to the handling of the Ukraine war, which is going to be completely kind of like biased, completely propagandistic, yeah. In relation to the Palestine conflict, there's been different views, different voices, you know, a whole range of information has been put before the consumers of this media. So it gives me, you know, that's restored my faith. It gives me hope that maybe the same thing could happen in relation to the Ukraine war. And in fact, there are signs that is happening. There's much more, you know, more realistic, more balanced, more skeptical coverage of the Ukraine war in Western media than there was before. So that's that. I think the second thing is that, you know, when you look at what's going on in relation to Gaza, and you compare it to what's going on in relation to Ukraine, just in relation to, you know, civilian casualties. Yeah. Now, according to the United Nations, their latest count of confirmed civilian casualties in Ukraine is about 10,000. Okay, that's an underestimate. There's more, but confirmed count 10,000-ish, including a few hundred children being killed in Ukraine, and that's in 18 months of war, of this vast kind of like military conflict. Yeah, we don't need to overwrite it, as compared to what's happened in the last 2 or 3 months in Gaza, where you've got 12, 4, I'm not sure what the latest figure is, 14,000 civilian casualties in Gaza, including at least, is it 4,000 children killed, something like that. So that kind of like contrast, I think that might open people's eyes to, you know, about what's actually been going on in Ukraine. And it doesn't like conform to the propaganda stereotypes and, you know, the accusations about atrocities and genocide and all that kind of stuff. So in that sense, the contrast between, you know, because the war, you know, the Gaza thing is being covered relatively in a relatively balanced way compared to the Ukrainian war, I think that's good in terms of maybe might help people to adopt a more skeptical kind of attitude to the treatment of the Russian side of the Ukrainian war that is typically dished out by the Western media. But the first point, of course, is that I think it's the girls are kind of like conflict. I think does make the possibility of peace in Ukraine that much more probable. Yeah, because it's a question of resources. Is that it will in the future mean less Western resources available to Ukraine. The thing about Ukraine war, fundamental one, say, look, no, without Western support, massive Western aid, Ukraine couldn't fight this war at all. The war would be over if Western support stops or dwindles significantly. The war could come to an end very quickly, just because the Ukrainians would be able to fight it anymore. But also, I think that because of the priority that Israel has for the United States, other EU countries as well, I think that will make them more inclined to try to find some kind of like end and resolution of the Ukrainian problem. It's terrible what's going on in Palestine, Gaza, Israel, all different points of view, but it might actually do some good in terms of this of the war in Ukraine. But the other point to make there is, of course, is that once the war in Ukraine comes to an end, right, and sooner it comes to an end, the sooner there can be a focus on other issues, in crucial global issues, which require cooperation, collaboration, resources, and require the involvement of Russia in their resolution. And that includes, of course, the whole Middle East conflict, the Palestine, Israel issue. What should be happening in Palestine, and it's not happening because of the Ukraine war, I think in major part, is there should be, Russia and all the great powers should be collaborating together to find a solution to the issues there, a solution that satisfies, Palestinians, Gazans, but also, deals with Israeli concerns, concerns as well. So there's all kinds of like costs in terms of this, the effects of the Ukraine war. All kinds of, and I think it's including the negative impact that the Ukraine war indirectly is having on the situation in the Middle East.